What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Eyewitness History. Dennis Elliott was born in England in the 1920s. When his father left his mother and she remarried, his stepfather sent him to an orphanage at the age of three. The place was a Dickensian nightmare, with staff going around rapping the children on the knuckles for any sort of misbehavior. Dennis's life was brutally difficult, and it wasn't until the Second World War broke out that everything in his life began to change. He joined the RAF and overcame the lack of confidence and self-esteem that plagued his childhood and wanted to become a skilled pilot, flying operations against Japanese forces in Burma, Malaysia, and Thailand. Today's guest is Philip Martin, and he knew Dennis when the latter was an elderly man spending his retirement years gardening. Dennis told him stories about his life flying B-24 Liberator missions, fearing the plane crash at any moment along bombing runs. Philip is the author of the new book, From Orphan to High Flyer. We look at Dennis's stories of perseverance, finding purpose, and seizing opportunities in the most unlikely of circumstances. It's a very human look at the many people involved in fighting World War II. And now I give you Philip Martin. Okay, I'm here with Philip Martin. Philip, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you. Really excited to discuss certainly you, your writing, and your new book, From Orphan to High Flyer. Before we do, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
So basically, I was the best friend of a former World War II RAF bomber pilot. And how I came to know him is when I was 10, he sold his car to my mother. And he had no family of his own at all. It was just him on his own. And over the years, the three of us became very close. And as I entered my teenage years, I developed a strong interest in history. So when he would come over for lunch, I would, you know, ask him basic questions, you know, where did you serve? What aircraft did you fly? And so forth. And he really began to open up. He would show me his logbooks, really take me deep into this, into his operational flying and other parts of his RAF career. He really brought it alive for me. And when I was 18, I began to help him around the house. He asked me to help him around the house on Saturdays and with his garden too. So I readily accepted it. And every Saturday I would go over there and cut his grass and trim his hedge or whatever he wanted done. And afterwards we would sit down and over cups of tea, he really began to open up and he would tell me about his childhood, his years in the RAF and really paint a picture of his operational flying and what he faced and what he accomplished as such a young man, which was quite humbling for me at the time. And I really began to recognize what a caliber of a man was sat before me. But the true catalyst for the book was in 2018, Dennis came very close to death. He almost died. And I visited him in the hospital every day. And I knew that Dennis's incredible life story was almost lost and that it had to be recorded. Now, I never thought of trying to convince him to write a book about it in the beginning, but it quickly became that. And I asked Dennis if he would be willing to do it, completely expecting him to say no, because he was quite a private man. But I just knew that there was such a value in these stories, and every account of a historic event or journey taken is unique, and there's always something you can learn. And with Dennis's life, there's a lot that the reader or anyone really can learn. So I pitched it to him. Unfortunately, he agreed. And for the next 3 years, he poured his heart and soul into this book. I became his full-time book carer. So we had a lot of time to work on it. And yeah, he went deep into his soul. He really brought up a lot of stuff I didn't know about his traumatic childhood, the beatings from his foster father, his own lack of self-confidence, and then how the war changed his life. And it was incredible to read how this frightened little boy became this strong, confident pilot and to just sit in front of him and listening to this. And at the time, I realized how fortunate I was. But Dennis passed away in 2021, just after the book was released. And now to have this book, it has another special layer to it because Dennis is now immortalized forever. Yes. And it's resonated with a lot of people. And I think there's those who love the military aspect and there's those who love the personal story. You know, I think there's a lot out there who never got the chance to listen to their grandparents who served in the Far East or in the war in general recount their story. And I think it kind of fills a gap to some degree. It fills that gap a little bit, at least, based on the people who I've spoken to who read the book. But yeah, he was the greatest man I ever met and he changed in my life. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to come on and talk about him, really.
Oh, no problem, Philip. That pleasure, that honor is mine. And as someone with a grandfather who served in World War II, I can pick you up on that last bit, having read the book. But I want to kind of wind the clock back and sort of track through the book as we go along. You gleaned at it just a minute ago there, Philip. I know Dennis Elliott was an orphan who had a very challenging childhood, to put it mildly. Despite this, he overcame those challenges. As you point out, he found his way into the British ATC after World War II and after World War II broke out. So perhaps I'll phrase it this way. What was the ATC? How did Dennis get into it, and what did he learn from his time in it?
So the Air Defence Cadet Corps, which later became the Air Training Corps, Dennis joined it in October 1940 at the age of 16, and essentially it prepared young men for a career in the RAF. Now, the Air Defence Cadet Corps was the beginning, really, of Dennis's transformation. He always said that the war was one of the best things that ever happened to him, which, you know, is quite baffling, really. Yes. It's quite a phrase, but in Dennis's case, it's very true. So as a result of Dennis's years in the orphanage, not knowing what happened to his true parents and the beatings he got at the hands of his first foster father and the lack of love from a second foster mother, Dennis was a boy by his own admission with very little self-confidence or self-esteem. The last person you would imagine to become a RAF bomber pilot in command of a crew. But Dennis said, you know, joining the Defence Cadet Corps and being in that at the ATC, he began to learn things, pass exams, meet new friends, achieve things, grow, and for the first time in his life, begin to really believe in himself, that he was actually worth something and could do things. And an ironic thing in it all is Dennis never wanted to go into the Air Training Corps. He wanted to go into the Sea Cadets because his passion was always the sea. He wanted to go into the Navy. But his foster mother vetoed it because the Sea Cadets were closer to London than the Air Training Corps. London was being hit quite badly at this time during the Blitz. And the Battle of Britain wasn't long over either. So for a young boy, you know, going to work and coming back from work and living day-to-day life with German aircraft going overhead and British aircraft in the skies and anti-aircraft fire, it was quite something for Dennis. But as anybody who reads the book will see, there was a lot of decisions made on Dennis's behalf that had a massive impact on his life and really changed in the course of his life, and that was one of them.
Yeah, very much so, Philip. I appreciate it. When Dennis was old enough, I know he joined the Royal Air Force, as you point out, and soon he went to South Africa and Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, for training. Please tell me about his experiences there.
Yeah, so Dennis was called up in October 1942, and in December he was put on the troop ship SS Rangitiki to Durban in South Africa, and on that journey he went through the crossing the line ceremony and witnessed quite a lot. And sadly, the convoy in front of them was hit. So there were quite a few bodies in the sea as well after being attacked by German U-boats. But anyways, yeah, so Dennis, after arriving in South Africa, was quickly sent to Southern Rhodesia to undergo pilot training. And it was a pretty intense 11 months, really, for Dennis. There was a lot to cover. And his first flying school, Hillside, he was there from the 20th of January to the 4th of June, 43. There wasn't any aircraft and there was no flying at all. He prepared for 10 exams on 10 different subjects on a wide array of things to really prepare him for what was to come. And after that, he went on to his second school, which was June 43 to August 43, where he went to learn to fly the Tiger Moth, which was a biplane. And there were more exams, but this time it was 7 exams on 7 subjects. And after almost being killed during his time there due to poor instruction by a Battle of Britain war veteran, no less. Dennis, shall we say, due to a bit of luck with his third instructor, who managed to see the flaw, shall we say, in Dennis's technique, managed to get Dennis through that school, and on he went to Kamalo. All these schools were in Rhodesia. But yeah, Kamalo from August to December 43, where he learned to fly the Oxford, which was a twin-engine aircraft. And during that time, you know, him and another cadet, one would be the pilot, one would be the navigator, and they really learned to kind of do mock operations as such and really prepare them for the next step. But Southern Rhodesia was always a country that Dennis liked. It was a bit of a defining moment, I think, for him in many ways. And yeah, it's a fascinating account listening to the personal stories of his time there, and even, you know, kind of what they had, and the nice kind of human elements of going swimming and all those things. But there was tough times as well, with two cadets on the course when they were on Oxfords were killed by huntsmen in Bekoala land, which is now Botswana, and they were cut up, and you know, their fat was used and for medicine and black magic and stuff. And yeah, so there was always a risk there. But it was a period of his life which overall he really enjoyed and learned a lot from.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you, Philip. I appreciate it. Let's pick it up from there then. So I know from December 1943 to October 1944, he spent time in Palestine and India, where he prepared to pilot a bombing crew. What specific kinds of things did he do during this time?
So, yeah, Dennis, after pilot training, was posted up through Africa to Egypt. And after a few weeks in Cairo, he was posted to Palestine, as it was then. So Dennis arrived in Palestine in February 44, but as a 19-year-old going on 20, he formed his crew and converted to the Vickers Wellington, which is a British twin-engine bomber aircraft. And at this point, Dennis is kind of on the ascent in his life. And I think a lot of people who have been through, you know, tough times where they've kind of grown from it and will really resonate with this arc that Dennis was on. But basically, he formed his crew. They had a drink to commemorate it. First time with Dennis to drive alcohol in his life. And later that night, he threw up everywhere. Unbelievably. But yeah, they began to work as a team, essentially, after with Dennis had basically learned to fly there on the Wellington. They started to kind of go on exercises them together and basically to work as a team for the operations to come. But, you know, there's also on the wider story in what was going on during the war and in the world in general. And Jerusalem and Palestine, as it was then, was going through quite a defining period, shall we say. And it's very interesting to listen to Dennis's tales from his time in Jerusalem as well, just from a personal perspective of his, you know, and the tension in Jerusalem and the feeling there, you know, because the Stern Gang and similar groups were quite active at the time. So it was quite something. And it's very fascinating to listen to this because, yes, Dennis recounts his time as a serviceman, as a pilot, but there's also that insight into the personal realities of him being in these countries going through great change and going through great or historic defining periods, and Jerusalem was one of them. But yeah, he also had time in Tel Aviv and various other places, and yeah, it was quite something, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Some amazing, staggering. So I know from October then, 1944, to January 1945, Dennis flew no less than 23 missions over Burma and Thailand. I was wondering, Philip, if you could please tell me about two or three of those.
Yes, so basically, there was still a very big Japanese presence in Burma, obviously. The battles of Imphal and Kohima weren't long over. So the supply lines and everything to the Japanese army in Burma, there was a vital importance to disrupt them, if not destroy them to the greatest extent possible. So the role of Dennis's squadron, 159 squadron, was to disrupt and destroy as much of these Japanese supply lines as possible. And I guess that, you know, Dennis had many quite incredible operations, really, where he dealt with anti-aircraft fire, storms, you know, because the monsoon weather out there is no joke, you know?
Yeah.
even friendly fire and the rest of it. But the one operation which has always stood out for me were the three operations on Penang Harbour. Now, Penang Harbour was a vital link in the supply chain for the Japanese army in Burma. It was so important that even German U-boats used to dock there and resupply and everything. And what makes Penang so incredible is that many echelons of the RAF and the United States Army Air Force, as it was then, didn't believe it could be done. And Dennis had a very charismatic commanding officer in 159 Squadron. His name was James Blackburn. And he was just one of those men who thrived in the war and whose men really worshipped him, if you will. He inspired them confidence in his men. And he has a wonderful archive in the Imperial Museum in London. So if anyone's ever there, well, give it a look. It's fascinating. But anyway, so the Penang operations took place from the 27th to the 28th of October 44. And it was basically a 3,000-mile trip to Penang in Malaya. Now, what was quite incredible is that the 3,000-mile trip was undertaken in B-24 Liberators, which only had a range of about 2,400 miles. So, obviously, this 600-mile extra distance had to be overcome. So, essentially, their runway wasn't long enough. So they had to take off from a B-29 Super Fortress airfield named Wakaragapur, as it had a much longer runway. So on the 26th of October, the day before the actual raid, all 15 Liberators were loaded a diggery with four mines. The overload fuel tanks were fitted and they were taken to Wakaragapur. Then once they were there, they were filled up with 3,000 gallons of fuel in total, the normal fuel tanks and the extra fuel tanks, because it worked out a gallon a mile, unbelievably. Then that night, they were taken back by Dakota or C-47 Skytrains to American listeners back to Diggory to spend the night in their own quarters. Now, then the next day, they were taken back to Wakaragapur. Now, Dennis always said that the American airmen were actually very nice, you know, handing out sweets and so forth and giving words of encouragement, because they were really going into the unknown, because the knowledge on what defenses Penang had was quite limited, and really, nobody really knew intelligence and didn't really have much information in what they could expect there. And because of that, and not even really knowing if the B-24 Liberator could make it there and back, a 50% casualty rate, a minimum, was generally expected, you know, which is quite staggering, really. But fortunately, Royal Naval destroyers in the area were put on alert, and there were two Royal Navy submarines, one-third of the way there, the second two-thirds of the way there. And the navigators of every B-24 Liberator were given the coordinates of the destroyers and the submarines with the idea that if anything went wrong and an attempt to ditch was necessary, that the Liberator in question would do so as close to a destroyer or a submarine's location as possible, which really highlights the complexity and the depth of organization that went into this. You know, also, each Liberator's guns and turrets were removed except for the rear gunner turret in order to reduce weight, as was the plating behind the captain's seat. So really, these Liberators were really stripped down to their bare minimum. And yeah, Dennis recounts that Blackburn had all the pilots around him for a talk. And he said, look, guys, I'm going to take off first. And if I don't make it, then it's up to every one of you what to do. So Dennis recounts, you know, seeing Blackburn's B-24 Liberator taxi to the beginning of the runway and then perform a precautionary takeoff and just about creak into the air. And yeah, every B-24 Liberator took off after him. Every B-24 Liberator made it back. Every B-24 Liberator successfully dropped their mines. Every B-24 Liberator made it back, and there was not even a single engine failure. And it was absolutely incredible. So much so that Dennis told me that the United States Army Air Force wished to give every crew member who took part the American Distinguished Flying Cross.
Wow.
But the RAF were vetoed it for, as Dennis said, it wasn't in their nature to just hand out awards, shall we say. So James Blackburn accepted the American Distinguished Flying Cross on behalf of the entire squadron. And it was repeated twice more, and Dennis was only one of six men to actually complete all three, believe it or not. But it's just quite staggering to picture a 20-year-old co-pilot, because this was only Dennis's third operation, so he was screened by more experienced pilots at the time who showed him the ropes, so to speak. But still, it's incredible to imagine a 20-year-old in that position, you know, right, we're going in this aircraft and we've no idea what defences then we're going to meet, but, you know, all the best, so to speak. And it's quite humbling, and the bravery and courage which many of that generation embodied, did it.
Yeah, absolutely. The bravery and courage of the greatest generation could be its own podcast series, as far as I'm concerned.
So many stories. And this is what was so important to me, really, because they say that whenever an elderly person dies, a library burns. And that generation, what they went through, not only as a group, but as individuals, is truly staggering. And every veteran has, in my opinion, a unique story to tell, which many lessons can be learned from. So for Dennis to go from this frightened orphan down to this competent, confident and pilot, I just had to get it down. Unfortunately, he agreed and poured his heart and soul into it. And here we are.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And as you know, we're kindred spirits here. I've spoken with a number of World War II veterans who have told me their stories. Absolutely. A word we keep finding ourselves using, staggering.
Yeah.
To be the perfect one, stories.
And you know what? Even in the advanced age, you can still see the strength and the steel in their eyes, can't you?
Yes. Yes, you can. First off, the memory is phenomenal. I'm sure that's been your experience as well.
Yeah.
Granted, it's not something that one would forget, but just the fact that something that happened, you know, 40 years before I was born, 50 years before I was born, whatever, could still be fresh in their mind. I remember when I interviewed Colonel Bud Anderson, you know, famous, the only surviving World War II Triple Ace fighter pilot. He was describing dogfighting strategy to me, and that was 20 minutes of our discussion, just going completely off of memory.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's quite something. And that was always kind of a key reflection for me, which I constantly did, it seemed, during the book, is reflecting on where I was at, say, 18, 19, 20, compared to where Dennis was at 18, 19 or 20. Because fortunately, we live in such a safe kind of world and environment now. And the idea of, I don't know, storming a beach to machine gun fire and, you know, hand-to-hand combat in cities and battlefields, just fortunately, I guess, it's so far removed and it's so hard to comprehend. And it was incredibly humbling to sit before Dennis and hear how, you know, he saw his friends get killed and engine fires and mining raids and not knowing what defenses, you know, were Penang and all these things. It's incredibly humbling, and I learned and it really made me an effect on my life as well, and I took so much from it, and it really made me a better man, I think.
Yeah.
If I'm honest.
Yeah. For me on my end as well. So, Philip, I know after his tour of duty, as the pilot bombing missions ended, Dennis received, I know, a very different assignment. Please tell me about his time flying in India and the Far East from February to October of 1945.
Yeah. So, Dennis, after Dennis's tour of operations, he had a pretty good year in the Far East. You know, he wasn't on tour, or he wasn't on an operation of squadron anymore, but he was basically flying Warwicks and later on C-74 Skytrains around India, Burma, and that Bay of Bengal area, all the way down to Singapore and later on into Malaya. And basically, the role of what he was doing was transporting troop and freight. And he absolutely loved it. He had such a good time. But, you know, Dennis loved flying so much that his health, shall we say, suffered because he wasn't eating enough. And he actually ended up in Bombay Military Hospital quite underweight because he was just so desperate to fly. He loved it. And, you know, on another occasion, he was flying, I believe, a Sentinel, and he knew he was going to pass out. So he found a salt flat and managed to land there and promptly passed out. And a period of time later, awoke to a big group of men brandishing sticks who were quite, and tools and weapons, if you will, who were very angry. Unfortunately, an Anglo-Indian gentleman who I assumed managed the salt flats or owned it, can't exactly remember, he came out and solved it, and kind of with Dennis went with him and was given a bed and everything, and they had a very interesting conversation, and it was these about the future of India and everything. And it was very interesting listening them to these personal little stories away from the flying too, you know, but there was still risk with flying. He suffered engine fire on an overloaded C-47 Skytrain. And yeah, there was also, like I said, his, shall we say, health not being as good as it should have been. And yeah, but it was a great year for him. And he ended up in Malaya with Malaya Communications Squadron. And that was quite fascinating, really, because the Malaya crisis was quite a big, shall we say, conflict, which is quite often overlooked. And when you listen to Dennis recount his time there, you really see the origins of it, if you will, you know, like, and the communists were still quite well armed and they were making their presence known. I mean, well, for example, Dennis and his crew became friends with a garage owner who used to rent them a car. And this garage owner was later found and murdered in the back, which Dennis always believed was due to his friendliness with the British, shall we say. And also a train he was on was hit with gunfire as he was asleep, and just things like that. And you just see the tension, if you will, in Malaya. And also he flew to with Java, which the Dutch were working on getting back under their control. And Dennis said, you know, we were in this hotel issued with sidearms, and you could just hear the gunfire during the night and stuff like that. And you think he's still only 21 at this point. It's quite something. But it was a great year of his life, with so much so that when the CEO called him into his office and said, good news, and Dennis, you're going home. He said, home? I don't want to go home. He said he was having the time final of his life there, while all he was hearing from Britain was rations and bad weather. And yeah, it was a great year.
Wow, it's incredible. Yeah, so I know, Philip, after the war ended, as you mentioned, he was stationed in Malaya for several months. After that, he was sent home. What happened while he was in Britain up to 1949?
Well, we see a very different Dennis return to Britain than the one who left Britain on the SS Rangitiki. And basically, Dennis was soon posted to the county of Norfolk and became an adjutant, which basically was a desk job, if you will. And Dennis absolutely hated it. He said the only reason he went into the Air Force and one was to fly, and he wasn't flying. And every CO he asked would say, yes, I'll get you back on the flying. And it never happened, because obviously there were so many men being demobilized at this point that, you know, there was such a high turnover of COs. So when September 1947 came around, when Dennis left the RAF because he wasn't flying. So he then had a year and a half doing kind of jobs and trying to adjust back to civilian life, but just didn't really take to it. And I think that's just something that many veterans, even and today, can really resonate with, that sudden transformation from an armed serviceman living that life to a civilian who now has to kind of start along that journey. And it didn't really sit well with Dennis, but he then, like everyone, realized that the Berlin airlift was starting and the volume of flying involved with that. So Dennis saw that as his way back onto flying. So he reapplied to the RAF, and the application process took so long that by the time he had passed through the flying schools, the Berlin airlift was long over. But he re-entered the RAF in April 49 and was soon posted to Kinloss, where he converted onto the famous Lancaster bomber. And as he said, he was back onto flying and he was the happiest man alive, back onto what he loved. And then the next big period of Dennis's RAF career began when in November 49, the 4th of November 49, he was posted to Malta with 38 Squadron, which, yeah, had some very interesting tales during that time. And it was interesting to contrast the role of the RAF from wartime to peacetime, if you will, as well, and how Dennis's flying really changed.
Yeah. No, thank you for all that, Philip, because you actually allowed me a pretty smooth transition onto my next question. So, yeah, so Dennis leaves the RAF in 1947. He rejoined as an enlisted man 2 years later. And then over the next 3 years, he served in a variety of locations, primarily in Malta, as you point out. I'd love to hear, and I'm sure our listeners would love to hear, about a couple of adventures he had during this time.
Well, so basically, the main role of Dennis's flying was to work in conjunction with the RAF, because there was a strong belief at the time that the Soviet Union would flood the Mediterranean with submarines. So a lot of Dennis's flying was exercises in how to work with the Navy to counteract this threat. But At the same time, as Dennis recounted to me, Lancasters by this time were getting quite old in aircraft terms, and there was a bit of a joke going around where they were kept together with string and chewing gum. And to think that there's this view going around, and yet you quite happily get behind the controls of one and go several thousand feet over the sea, it's quite amusing, really. But one which really stood out for me is Dennis told me that they were receiving instruction in the control tower before an exercise. And the Mediterranean and the sea around Malta, the Mediterranean around Malta, was divided into boxes, like codes, you know. And there was another crew receiving their instructions for their exercise. And Dennis just overheard a box number. So later on, Dennis hears a mayday call during his exercise, during his flight, and he asks around his crew, he said, did anybody else hear that? Nobody else did. And it was just some the one, he said. And he said, I sat there and I thought about it. And he said, I was absolutely adamant that I heard this mayday call. And then he remembered the box number he heard from the other crew. So he said he sat there again and he called up the control tower and he was giving the orders to carry on with his exercise. And Dennis thought about it and he said, no, I'm going to go to this box. Now, as captain of the aircraft, he could make that decision, but if he was wrong, he would have been in serious trouble. But he went to the box and not long later, he found this crew, same crew from the control tower, in the lifeboat. And he contacted, the authorities, and the crew were eventually picked up. And what had happened was, as Dennis later found out, is that part of the starboard wing of their Lancaster had just fallen off. So it had to kind of ditch in the water. And he was told that when the flight engineer hit the button to release him a dinghy, it wouldn't come out. So they had to manually hack it out before the Lancaster sank. And it was absolutely amazing, really, to think how Dennis's intuition saved this crew. And to contrast that with the boy that Dennis was to the pilot he became, and there's plenty of stories, both during his tour of operations and afterwards, but that was one which really stood out to me in his post-war flying. But yeah, but sadly, not all of the crew survived. There was a chap who was on national service, and he died on a destroyer headed back on Pomalti. He was picked up a lot of pass around the back. And the ground engineer, I believe, was never found either. So there's a bit of tragedy there. But fortunately, Denison was on hand. And what was quite interesting is that Dennis told me that the flight engineer from that crew had said to his fellow crew members that if 38 Squadron, Dennis's squadron, if 38 Squadron were on air sea rescue, they'd be waiting there and for bloody days. And then not long after, Dennis showed up. But yeah, no, it was an interesting time. You also had detachments in Gibraltar, in Cyprus, and in Northern Ireland. But yeah, this is kind of... Malta was a country that Dennis liked a lot. And, he met James Blackburn there twice, which is a fascinating story because as we later discover in the book, Blackburn, for reasons that Dennis some never knew, actually kept tabs on Dennis, we believe. So we wonder to this day, I wonder to this day, if the meetings were, chance meetings as such. So even when Dennis got married, after he left the RAF, he received a letter of congratulations from James Blackburn. Now, what baffled Dennis is the house he was living in had no connection to the RAF at all. So it's not as though his address was on a database and him and Blackburn weren't in touch. So how did he find his address? But he did. So there you go.
Wow. It's incredible. Let me see. Okay. In 1952, Dennis became part of the School of Maritime Reconnaissance, and it was here he served for the next several years. What would you say, Philip, was the most exciting thing that happened to him during this time?
What I liked and what Dennis always kind of liked for that period of his life was kind of working with the next generation of airmen to basically work in conjunction with the Navy, because qualified air crew were sent to the School of Maritime Reconnaissance and then they were trained to work in conjunction with the Navy. But there were some aging Lancasters and accidents happening as a result of them was something that reared its head at the School of Maritime and Reconnaissance. And one thing that I think a lot of servicemen can tell you is that there's certain superstitions that kind of go unspoken. And Dennis had experienced them both kind of during the war and after. And he recalled this story that he had this, he was due to fly on an exercise with students while at the School of Maritime Reconnaissance. And he just had a bad feeling. It's just a very strong feeling, and we're telling him not to fly. And he just said that on that night, nothing would have gotten him up in the air. And he just said he went and found a fault with the Lancaster and did the same with the one in reserve. And he just wouldn't fly. And eventually the CO called the exercise off. Now, the next day, Dennis didn't have this feeling. So he went up on an exercise in the Lancaster. And later that same day, the flight commander of B flight, who was also with students, went up in another Lancaster on a nighttime exercise. So Dennis's exercise went well and he landed at St. Morgan. And he went for his post-flight meal and went to bed. And not long after, he was awakened and told that he had to take the lifeboat equipped Lancaster to the nearby RAF airfield of St. Ethel, as nothing had been heard from this flight commander's Lancaster. Now, once arriving at St. Ethel, he'd only been there for about 2 or 3 hours when a message came through that a trawler, a fishing boat, had spotted wreckage and had picked up a body floating in the water. So it was found that one wheel had come to the surface still attached to its oleostruts, which was kind of a shocking component of the carriage. And there was a floating corpse picked up, which was the flight engineer with his head caved in. And what the authorities concluded was that the flight commander must have left his seat and handed controls to the flight engineer, who probably stepped on the undercarriage lever by accident. And once the undercarriage was down, drag on the aircraft increased, causing the nose end to lower and the speed of the aircraft to rise. And even though there was a bolt that locked the undercarriage lever in place, they were getting so old at this point that it was thought that the bolt had probably worn down and had snapped. But Dennis always kind of said that he always believed that it could have been him if he'd got up that night. It was that sort of superstition. But he just said it was just that feeling that if he'd gone up in the air, something would have gone dangerously wrong. But it's an interesting one, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was also other instances. Like there was a young chap on another squadron who forgot to put his undercarriage down and just slid along on the runway, sparks flying out. And Dennis knew that because he saw the whole thing. You know, there were times when he lost both inboard engines about 50 miles in from base.
Wow.
Yeah, there are just stories like that. And it's a fascinating insight. These quick split-second decisions have to be made. And Dennis had to make them from his tour of operations onwards. Even during his pilot were training, and there are split-second decisions he had to make. And I know I've said it already, but just to see this frightened little boy blossom into this confident, young, incredible pilot, it's just a story of growth and story of overcoming, which resonated and still resonates some with me and has done with many others.
Yeah, absolutely, Philip. The idea of instinct, maybe we can call it a refined instinct if someone had been in, you know, flying for so many years, something that always fascinates me. So I know it was finally 1957, he left the RAF for good, once and for all. Will you please tell me about the rest of his life?
Well, by the time that Dennis's RAF career came to an end, he'd met the woman who would become his wife, and Dennis had said that he never wanted to get married while in the RAF because he had seen so many pilots who had gotten married and, you know, a short time later ended up dead in crashes or by other means. He wouldn't even marry his wife until, or he wouldn't even marry him, the woman who became his wife, until he'd left the reserves. But they got married and they lived around England in various jobs, and Dennis, I think, he settled into civilian life quite easy because he had met some of the women he loved, you know? So it wasn't that bad. He had a pretty good life afterwards. But they got married and lived in various places around England. Tragically, she passed away of a stroke in 92. They never had any children. And by chance, he found a house in a village which was only a few miles from where I grew up. Then, you know, 2005, mutual friends put them in touch, sold his car to my mother. And the rest is history, as I say. But, you know, Dennis saw the first wave of sales from the book, and it was incredibly humbling, you know, because Dennis, like many veterans of the Far East, never really felt that they got the recognition that they should have. So to have people come up and shake his hand and ask him questions and thank him for what he did during the war, it made him quite emotional at times. And it used to surprise him a bit. I mean, I remember every year I would ask Dennis, do you want to go with me to the memorial service on Remembrance Sunday? And every year he'd say no. But every year I'd ask him. Then for some reason in 2019, he said, yeah, okay, I'll go. So he put on, you know, his jacket with his medals, and off we went. And it was so nice because Dennis was the only Second World War veteran there, and he was treated like a celebrity. And it was just so beautiful for me to just sit back and just watch, you know, just watch the public kind of see him for the war hero that he was. And it made him very emotional. And he said to me, he said, I can't believe these people are coming up to me. Why are they coming, you know, up to me and thanking me? Was that some sort of thing? And I sat there and, you know, I'm looking at him with these medals on his chest, his pilot's wings. And I thought, what do you mean? Oh, why are they coming up to you?
Yeah.
I mean, you're a true hero. And on the website for the book, and there's actually a photo of me and Dennis from that Memorial Remembrance Sunday event. And you can see the bigger smile on his face. And it was so beautiful that Dennis finally got that recognition, because he never really spoke about it much. He never bragged about it. His years in the RAF was never his identity. It was just something he did as a young man, you know. But for him to finally get that recognition, and then later on to see his, shall we say, the finished product of his heart and soul being poured into, to see the final published copy of the book, which he poured so much into, was just wonderful to see. And the cherry on the cake was in May 2021, we solved most of the mystery surrounding his biological family. So that all made it into the book as well, and that's quite something. So, yeah, to see this boy beaten up by his first foster father, running away from cricket balls, coming in his direction in school, no self-belief and confidence, to then, you know, captaining aircraft against the ferocious enemy in the Japanese, being thrown up thousands of feet in violent storms and taking control of split-second decisions, hitting Japanese targets, engine fires, you know, friendly fire even,
yeah,
balloon barrages, you know, then to dealing with sandstorms in North Africa during his time in Malta, accidentally ripping the end off a small boy's thumb, believe it or not, in Malta, and dealing with it, to see this growth, this transformation, to see the greatest man I ever met, to have seen him sat in front of me with tears in his eyes and recount his childhood, and later on the joy and adulation and recounting his flying and the depth and the richness he went into. It was the greatest honor of my life, and it's a privilege that I can share this with the public, and that Dennis's story is so accessible now. And it's a unique account by an incredible man of a theater of the war that, in my opinion, is very underappreciated and which not a lot of people really know about. And, you know, he was the greatest man I ever met, and he truly changed in my life. And it's just, and just the growth and, yeah, everything he went through, it was incredible.
Yeah, that's incredible, Philip. Thank you. Really grateful to you for the time. I feel like I should ask you, how can people find out about you?
The best way is to go to our website, www.fromorphan2highflyer.com. There's a lot more information on there. There's photographs from Dennis's archive on there. There's maps which detail, you know, his operations and his pilot training in Southern Rhodesia. And there's a nice link to the book in there as well, and to various other resources. So that's the best place to go.
Excellent. Yeah, the book, once again, is From Orphan to High Flyer. I highly, highly recommend it. Philip Martin, thank you so much for taking the time for me, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. We can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.